Gravity again, having finished our review of special relativity. On the first day, second day, we mentioned this remarkable law of Newtonian gravity. I'm not going to tell you what was here again. I'll just remind you that that's an extremely accurate, description of gravity in the solar system. In particular, the accuracy with which that people were able to work with that led to the discovery of new planets, or a new planet, Neptune in particular. However, what has been of interest in the past few days is special relativity, and so one of the comments was that this law is inconsistent with special relativity. And in particular, if I look at the force law in a Newtonian framework, what I'm thinking here is that the force at a given time depends on the position of the first mass at that time and the second mass at that time. But these masses are separated in space, and so different inertial observers are going to disagree as to what a specific time is or what a constant time slice is. And so they're going to disagree on the measurements of those two positions. And so, that just points to an inconsistency with the rules of special relativity. So, it depends on the two positions at the same instant of time. For different inertial observers, constant slices are different in different time inertial frames. And so basically this led Einstein to think about how to resolve this inconsistency, how to come up with a gravitational law that was going to be consistent with special relativity, and ultimately that led him to think or to produce a new framework to describe gravity, namely general relativity. So one of the key ideas
So if that's the only problem that there was, so then why can't you just construct a retarded potential like we do in E&M, and then that solves everything?
What equation is your retarded potential going to satisfy?
T minus R over C instead of T and in
integration. Okay, but in electromagnetism you have a four vector. Toss that aside and say there's a scalar potential. What equation does that scalar potential satisfy?
In electromagnetism?
Yeah.
Poisson equation.
Okay, but is the Poisson equation going to be consistent with special relativity? I mean, does it give you the solution that you just talked about?
I think so, no?
Yeah, what is it?
Where is time in that equation?
Okay, see.
But I mean, what does it matter, right? Like, you could say, I'm serious. Like, you could say, perhaps, the only thing we need to do to make this consistent with special relativity is to give off the idea of a potential, and instead just do direct, you know, body-to-body interactions with, you know, a retarded force.
Perhaps you could proceed in that way. Ultimately, I think, you know, what we are going to do is we are going to produce a theory implicitly it's a theory of a potential, and it will be consistent with special relativity. But and so ultimately it is going to satisfy not just a Poisson equation, but a wave equation. And that's where the time comes into the retarded potential. But well, one could start to fool around and you know try and write down that theory. But ultimately, what we're going to do is follow the path of Mr. Einstein, which leads us to a much more elegant framework in which to construct or to incorporate that potential. But ultimately, you're right. Ultimately, that's what we end up with. We end up with something that looks very much like electromagnetism. But you know that electrostatics had to be fixed, quote unquote, fixed up.
Well, it didn't have a point yet.
Sorry?
Electrostatics.
Yeah, we have no time dependent.
Oh, yeah, sure.
With that retarded potential, wouldn't it give incorrect predictions? Like the size of the galaxy that's a few light years across, wouldn't you then just, like, they wouldn't predict the right shape and size of the galaxy, for example? Because.
Sorry, where did we start? I guess I missed the beginning.
If we take this new theory we've been working on, wouldn't it make incorrect predictions? Like, isn't that a good reason to forget about it?
Well, it's hard for me to say what the predictions are, because I'm not really sure what theory we're talking about.
The naive retarded force.
Yeah, right. Just like, can't we imagine that it's going to get
but
a whole bunch
rather
of
rather remarkably, well, I won't go there, I think actually the answer to your question naively would be no, but it turns out, basically the motion of the stars in a galaxy and the gravitational interaction, that's pretty much something that you can describe with just ordinary Newtonian mechanics, except for the fact that it gets it all wrong, because of the fact that we believe there's something extra out there called dark matter.
Yeah.
But if I incorporate dark matter with that Newtonian potential, or a density of matter for dark matter, but I still use Newtonian potential, basically I get the dynamics of the galaxy. When you run these complicated computer simulations, they do not put general relativity in there, except the more advanced simulations would basically expand the background space-time. If they're trying to evolve for a long time, they have to expand the universe. But the interactions are basically
solid. Okay.
But we are drifting. One more question.
I think the retarded potential thing, like, does GR reduce to that somehow?
Yes.
It would have to.
Yeah. So one of the key ideas in Einstein's construction his new theory of gravity or general relativity was the equality of gravitational and inertial mass.
Could you turn the microphone on?
Sorry?
Can you turn the microphone on?
You're wearing it.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Yes, I did.
There I am. Okay, sorry about that. So what I just said is one of the key ideas is the equality of gravitational and inertial mass for a particular body. Of course, to say that they're equal, first of all, I have to distinguish them or give you a definition of what I mean. So when I'm talking about the gravitational mass, so I might write a G subscript there. What I mean is the mass that appears in the Newtonian force law or in the Newtonian potential. There's a quantity here that's basically the charge or the analog of charge that yields the gravitational force. So it's the So by this, I mean the mass entering as charge in that equation up there. So inertial mass, I'll give it a subscript I here. In this case, I mean now, Newton gave us another law. Given a force, there's the response of some body to that force, namely the second law. So the mass here is the mass that enters in So given a force, there's ma, mass times acceleration. So this is a different parameter in principle, but it's given the same name, mass, and so that we're going to distinguish it now by calling it the inertial mass. Now we talked about, instead of talking about a force law, we talked about the potential. So that would be the gravitational potential, and it's familiar to many of us. I introduced the idea a couple of lectures ago. So we recall the gravitational so this again, it's the analog of the electrostatic potential, but I can think of it as the potential energy, the gravitational potential energy, divided by the mass. And here, I mean divided by the gravitational mass. So this is gravitational potential energy per unit mass. And so the simplest example is if I have a point-like source or a spherical mass, then I just get phi equals minus gm over r. So I want to combine the Newtonian force law expressed in terms of that potential with the second law. So on the one hand, the Newtonian force, or gravitational force, I can write as, in terms of the gradient of this potential, to get turn it back into the force, I introduce the mass. This is the gravitational mass, and there's a minus sign there as usual. But then the second law over there says that this is the inertial mass times the acceleration. Or in other words, the acceleration is minus mg over mi times the gradient of that potential. And so if the ratio there is just one, i.e. if the inertial and the gravitational masses are the same, then we get the famous result that all masses or all bodies are going to accelerate in the same way in a gravitational field. Or we can recall Galileo's famous experiments of dropping balls off of the, or famed experiments, of dropping various cannonballs off of towers and seeing that they all accelerate in the same way.
I guess I wrote it the other way. So if this ratio of 1 And so in that case, what we do is we just write the local acceleration due to gravity, or we express the gravitational field in terms of some g. So implicitly in writing that last equation, I've thrown that away. And so we see that g is just the gradient up to a sign of our gravitational potential. So as well as dropping cannonballs off of towers, in fact, there are modern experiments that confirm this ratio being 1. So modern experiments they verify this ratio being 1 to a few parts in 10 to the 13. So that's, well, that's a lot of zeros. That's a remarkably accurate result. In fact, it's one of the most accurate results that we have, or measurements that we have in physics. And I'm not going to describe in detail those experiments, but I'll refer you to the book. Yeah?
This is nitpicking, but technically, for all worlds calculated at the same rate in gravity, the ratio doesn't need to be 1. It just needs to be a constant.
This is true. Yes.
So how do we get to 1?
Let's pick that constant in a way that it is 1. That's just a choice of units. In the same way that we could measure 1 in kilograms and the other in pounds, I wouldn't get 1 here. But there's, you're right. Ultimately, it's just a constant. But since they have the same units, we're going to choose the units so that we're picking 1 there.
No, but it couldn't be. One can imagine a universe in which you have 1 kg mass which falls in gravity at a certain acceleration, and for an equivalent force, it accelerates twice as much.
But my claim is that ultimately that would have been a choice of units.
I mean,
it would have gone into here or into Newton's constant, what we decide Newton's constant was.
I see it.
So if you don't mind, I believe in old, like, Israeli units in the U.S., they actually used a unit of force that was inconsistent with a unit of mass, or a unit of weight that was inconsistent with a unit of force, so that it actually wasn't constant.
And so where is the book where we could find the experiments?
Sorry?
What is the book where we could find the experiments?
Read the Hartle. I mean, Hartle has a description of some of these, of the Hutchbush experiments, or the modern versions of them, in chapter 6. But this is going to bring us... But Einstein then took this idea and ran with it, or he was inspired by this idea, and did several thought experiments. And so I just wanted to describe those briefly. So there are 4 situations that I want to consider.
In all of these situations, what we have is a lab. These are all identical pictures. We have a brave experimenter. He's holding up a cannonball, say, or an apple, whatever inspires you, and a feather. The laboratory is evacuated. And then, well, I'm not going to draw those. Somebody else is going to draw those. What he does is at time zero, he releases both of those objects. And we have to figure out, right, these are very simple experiments, simple situations, and we have to decide what happens to those objects. And so, I'm going to need four volunteers to describe each one of these situations. And my volunteers will be, are there any volunteers? Which would you be? You would be Eric. Okay. So you get to describe situation number one. So you can go to the board. This was t equals zero. What happens at finite time afterwards? Do we have any other volunteers? We'll go to the back. And your name is?
Soda.
Ah, okay. Soda. Very good. Okay, you get number two. We're still looking for two more volunteers. You have to draw a whole second lab. You guys can carry on. I've written the situation on the piece of paper if you look at it. And so you're supposed to draw in the picture what has happened after a finite interval delta t. No, you answer too many questions. Here's someone who asks difficult questions. Your name would be?
Prasanna.
Prasanna. Okay, here you get to do number three. And we need someone else. And that person would be staring at her page, Chantel. Is that right? Okay. So you get number four. So on your page, I've described the situation, which you're not supposed to reveal to the audience. You're just supposed to draw what happens. My art's making progress here. Excellent. You're done. Okay.
Is there some wind?
In this situation, spin 3 graviton causes a propeller beam to appear.
There's no quantum mechanics, it's just classical physics. They're holding those two operators. They're folding them up. Sorry? No, this is a feather. Whatever your paper is.
Can you drop them?
At t equals zero, he's holding them up and then he releases them. And the question is, what happens afterwards? Excellent, you're done. Good job. So we're all waiting for you, Chantel. No pressure there. But let's. No, you can't change your mind. Let them go. And then you're supposed to. That's right. Good job. Okay. Well, we'll discuss that. Okay, so in number one and number two, we have two different physical situations. In one universe, propeller campus. Okay. That's how we can tell they're different, I guess. Can someone, other than the Eric, tell me what physics is described here? Aaron?
The experimenter is in a rocket elevator.
The experiment is in a rocket elevator. And?
And so things fall to the ground.
What's the rocket doing?
The rocket is pushing, of course, the elevator in the opposite direction. But
so the cannonball is the elevator of the laboratory is accelerating upward. Eric, was that what you described?
No. Nope.
Yes or no? Okay. Any other suggestions? What's happening in number one? You're not allowed to. Larry, what? So So the other suggestion is the laboratory is on the surface of the Earth. He lets them go, and gravity carries the two objects down at identical rates. Eric, is that what you drew?
Ding, 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 ding.
We have a winner. Okay, number two. The picture looks the same, but I'm telling you that the situation is different. Any suggestions as to what's happening in this case? If you drew a picture, you can't answer.
Aaron's suggestion.
Aaron's suggestion. Okay, in this case, what we see is, or the suggestion is that the elevator is accelerating upward, and the lab and the experimenter are carried upward, but these two objects no longer are being accelerated, and so they fall to the ground, or appear to fall to the floor of the laboratory. Is that what you drew? Correct. So ding, 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 ding. The point of the experiment is, though, when we look at those two, just the physics, the experiment, what's happening in the laboratory, we cannot, in particular Aaron cannot, distinguish between those two situations. But he did not make a mistake. The physics that he sees in his accelerating elevator is the same as in this laboratory that's just standing at rest on the Earth. Now let's look at these other two situations. In this case, we're in the same laboratory, we're holding up the same objects, they're released, we didn't lower our arms, but we released the two objects, and nothing appears to happen. You've answered a question already, I'm going to ask somebody else. How about Chris? What happened in that?
In an accelerator, in an elevator accelerating in free fall toward the gravitational object, like here.
Is that what you drew?
No.
No. Any other suggestions?
You're just in space and no gravity?
Sorry?
You're just in space with no gravity?
I'm in an inertial frame in empty Minkowski space. Is that what you drew?
That's
correct. Here we have another picture of another situation. But again, the physics looks the same. Any suggestions as to what happened in this case?
What did Chris say?
Chris's suggestion. I forgot to do that. Oh, Chantel. What is it that you drew? Is Chris's suggestion the correct physics?
Yes.
Yes.
That was right here.
I'm sorry, Chantel. Charlotte.
Yes.
Yeah. Give me 3 weeks and I'll get it straight. Okay, the point was that we've done we've described various thought experiments, and the results, though, in each case, there were two different physical situations which produced the same physics. And that was Einstein's insight that just coming from the idea of the equivalence of the inertial and the gravitational mass. Unfortunately, I have to erase these beautiful pictures. And so, in particular here, what he said, or what he suggested was an equivalence principle. Which is that the law of I'll write it in what sounds like a very important way. The laws of physics have the same form in a uniformly accelerated frame, uniformly accelerated frame, as they do in an unaccelerated lab.
uniform gravitational field. And so this is what we're seeing here in one case, this was an accelerated lab. In the other case, it was a uniform gravitational field. But the physics that was resulting in that experiment was identical. And there's some discussion in the book as to precisely what a uniform gravitational field means. And I won't dwell on that. In a lab of a finite extent, there are always going to be very small perturbations. For example, in the width of this room, the gravitational field or the gravitational acceleration points, say, towards the center of the Earth, which is slightly a different direction here as it is on the other side of the room. And so you can, in practice, detect small non-uniformities or the effect of small uniformities in the gravitational field, but we won't. That complicates things, and so the beauty of this experiment is just to think about a uniform gravitational field.
This may seem like a really dumb question, but are we still then in the perspective of Newtonian physics? Because what would a gravitational field mean if we don't have, like, say, Newton's universe?
I guess the answer is yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we experienced. This is an experiment that I could do here in this room.
Okay.
In a field which causes changing acceleration, for example.
Yes.
If you continue to change with the same acceleration, you're still in a frame where the same laws of physics apply? So if I have a field which, instead of causing a constant acceleration,
right,
causes a varying acceleration,
that's okay. Happens.
Then if I'm in an elevator, which also varies at the same rate of acceleration. Even then, your pictures would be the same, right?
I'm sure that I could produce deviations if I push things hard enough. But again, I think to the extent that we're not approaching relativistic velocities and there's no strong gradients across the lab, I think you're right. Yeah, the pictures are going to be the same. So what you're saying is the precise motion here. It's not just that there's a picture and these things fall to the ground, but there's a precise distance that these things fall and a rate at which these fall. And yeah, there would be, which one was this? I think this was the gravitational field. If this guy was accelerating in a particular way, I could probably invent a gravitational field.
For example,
as long as there's a gradient.
Itself varies with time.
And
space.
No, actually, it's only very.
My only point of raising this is to check whether the emphasis on the word uniformity in your accelerated frame is really mattered.
I think it's not. Not going to worry about the details. In fact, at the end of the lecture, if we get there, I'm going to say, well, this is an interesting result for a uniform gravitational field, but it has a natural extension to a non-uniform gravitational field. So. But in any event, in case one here, we had a local acceleration due to gravity g that was pulling the objects down. In this case, the lab was accelerating upward with a equals, I guess, minus g, if that's a vector quantity. And the physics was, not just the falling to the ground, but the details of how those two objects fell to the bottom of the lab were the same.
One of the consequences then, well, I'll write it as a consequence, is what we saw in the second set of experiments. So that was namely that there was, in one case, no gravitational field. In the other case, we were moving through the gravitational field, but the effect of gravity was made to effectively vanish or produce the same physics as just an inertial frame. So locally then, the claim is it's always possible find a frame where and as suggested by the experiment that we had, we'll call this the freely falling frame. Namely, if the lab is falling or allowed to fall without any friction in the gravitational field, then there's no relative motion of the objects inside. All of the objects in the lab, as well as the lab, are accelerated in the same way. And this was a real, or Einstein felt this was a real revelation in that the gravitational field then has only a relative existence or effect. Even though there's a gravitational field here, by going to the appropriate frame, I can eliminate the effects of that field. Another one of the consequences, which has already been alluded to by several of you, is that if I think about light, then light will actually have to fall in a gravitational field. So if I think about empty space, then light is just going to follow a straight line. But if I am then making the measurements in a laboratory that's accelerated upwards, as it was here, with some acceleration, then if it enters here at some height h1 or z1, then it's going to leave on the other side of the lab . So the light enters, if the lab was at rest, it would enter here at some, I would measure the height z1, it would leave at z1, but because the lab is accelerating now, the light takes some time to traverse the laboratory, the lab's moved or accelerated, and so the height that I measure when it's leaving the lab is somewhat lower, i.e. it appears to me, or the observer in the lab, that a light has followed a trajectory where it's fallen towards the floor. That's simple kinematics, but the equivalence principle that Einstein postulated was that this physics should be indistinguishable from the physics that we see in a gravitational field. So this is
time with acceleration, but that's gravitational field. And so if the physics is indistinguishable, then in this case, again, I measure that it enters at Fed 1 and it leaves at Fed 2. And so in the gravitational field, it seems that the light has curved down or fallen down in the gravitational field.
Why would you choose any field?
Because in any field you could have an acceleration, and if you generate the same acceleration in your reference frame, you would experience the same physics. So if you, for example, you were in an electric field, for example.
Right, but if I was in an electric field, I wouldn't experience any acceleration. I might experience shocks or something, but I don't carry a charge. I'm not charged under the electric field.
Let's say there was a charge in an electric field, which has an acceleration.
Right, but the thing is that what we're talking about then is there's a new force law, the electrostatic. I mean, we'll just work with electrostatics, and there's a charge that's associated with that, the electric charge of the object. There's a response to that, but the parameter that enters the response, or Newton's second law, is the mass. So as long as all of the bodies that we choose have the same ratio of charge to mass, then I'll produce a similar physical situation. But the beauty of the gravitational field is that the charge was the mass. And so what appeared was this ratio, but then with a choice, well, with experiments, we were able to see that those two masses were actually not just parameters with the same units, but they were actually the same parameter.
I agree with what you're saying. But let's say through an external force, you apply exactly the same acceleration that the electric field would have
So, okay, so again, I'll just say I can create situations that have the same flavor, but again, what I'm going to demand is that the ratio of the mass to the electric charge be the same. And we know that that's not true for all physical bodies.
But you can, you know, for select bodies, prepare experiments in the way that you wanted. But what is true for all physical bodies is that this ratio of inertia to gravitational mass is always the same, period. And so I don't have to, this is something that's going to be true in general. I'll go to Chris.
There you have that diagram under light falls in a gravity. Yeah. The path length, upon naive inspection, the path length followed by the light that's falling is longer. So if the speed of light, given that the speed of light is constant, does that mean that there's a time?
I don't want to describe this in any great detail. To do this in this room, I mean, we could see this effect, in principle, we could see this effect, but it's an interesting exercise to figure out what that displacement would be for light crossing this room, and it would be an extremely difficult measurement to make.
Yeah, but I mean, as long as we're doing thought experiments and saying that we can detect that there is a non-trivial displacement,
For a room this size, I can't talk about a uniform gravitational field, and I can just use sort of classical or Newtonian. I'm just going to use sort of if you like, Newtonian, well, I don't even need Newtonian, I guess, I am using Newtonian physics to describe this situation over here and describe that path. And then I'm just the assumption is that I see the same path.
All right, so we're not,
we don't really have the technology yet, and we won't for a while, to describe the path of the light in an actual gravitational field, okay, doing it properly in a relativistic situation. I think Karen had a question.
Yeah, so you mentioned, you were saying, why can't we get rid of, say, electromagnetic forces in the same way as we get rid of gravitational forces?
Yeah.
So I believe this is exactly Kaluza-Klein theory. There's, like, somebody after Einstein published general relativity thought the exact same thing, and you can do it, in fact. And what you get, if I understand correctly, what you get is precisely Kaluza-Klein theory. And it's obviously not used anymore. I don't know quite why. I don't think it works exactly right.
So there were attempts a long time ago to incorporate electromagnetism in a geometric framework where we're not yet, but where we'll get very quickly, I hope, or perhaps. And it's not quite just electromagnetism. The if you like, the problem is that you also introduce a fifth force. And you introduce quantization laws that are not it doesn't match with what we see in the real world quite the way that it was possible in the simplest situation. So, however, it is revived actually in modern physics in a slightly different way. In string theory, or it becomes a part of string theory. Okay. Was there another question?
So the reason that you can't do the same thing with electromagnetism is the different charge mass ratios. So would that be like maybe you could do like a geometry thing, but you had to take the geometry particle by particle, like the curvature would look different for the different charge mass ratio particles?
That's a great question. Maybe I'll put it on the assignment. No, I don't know. I mean, the problem I can see is that we know in modern physics that, you know, you can convert one kind of particle into another kind of particle, or alternatively. Well, I'm not saying it's impossible. My guess is that it just becomes unwieldy and impractical. I mean, the kinds of processes I'm thinking about is that I can start with a neutron, which has no charge, but it can decay into an electron and a proton, which are now carrying opposite charges and have differing charge to mass ratios.
Right.
And so we're going to construct different space times for all of these different particles.
So, like, if there's a curvature formulation, it'd be like ultra wacky.
Okay. What was if there are no more questions, the last consequence I just wanted to talk about, actually, in more, well, first briefly and then in more detail, is the gravity effects. The way that blocks run. And so you can think, or what one could imagine is, again, a thought experiment of a rocket ship of some finite extent. And it's going to be accelerating upward with acceleration g. We can put clocks at the top and the bottom of the rocket ship. And we can compare the way those clocks are running by having, for instance, the physicist at the top of the rocket ship. He's watching the clock, and he sends regular light pulses, or light pulses downward at a regular rate, say 1 second apart. And then the observer down at the bottom is going to measure the time at which those pulses arrive, and he'll record this on his clock, the time separation between the arrival of the pulses. The thing is that this person is sending them out at a regular rate, but the rocket ship is accelerating, and so it's gaining velocity. This clock is catching up to the pulses, and so he's catching up at an ever greater speed, and so he ends up then measuring separation between the pulses that's different at the top and at the bottom, and that's an indication that his clock is running in a different way. And we're going to put some formulas to that. I'm just going to write the words now. We'll put some formulas to that in a moment. But the idea is then, I'll call him A and B. If A So this was very qualitative, and again, we'll put some formulas to that in a moment, but the idea was that of the equivalence principle, when I invoke that, the physics that we observe here in the accelerated rocket ship is the same as the physics of the same rocket ship sitting in a uniform gravitational field. And so in this case, I can infer or interpret this physics as saying that the clock here runs at a different rate than the clock here at a higher point in the gravitational field. So we interpret the results as indicating that
Okay. So let's see if I actually, I'll use this board over here. See if I can draw some pictures. So, okay, so here's my rocket ship initially at t equals zero. Then we're going to have t equals t1, t equals t2, equals t3. And so we have B in the bottom, A in the top. The separation here is H. The acceleration upward is G. And so it moves upward. And at each point here, the height that we've reached is just 1/2 g, the appropriate time squared. So here it's t1 squared. Now what we're going to do initially, or at t equals zero, A sends the first pulse. And what distinguished t1 is that's the point when the pulse arrived to the bottom of the rocket ship. And then T2 is distinguished as the time when we send our second pulse down. And then T3 is distinguished as the time when that pulse arrives here. And so we're going to call, so the time between pulses, according to A, is from t equals 0 to t equals 2. So we'll call this delta TA. The time between pulses for B is the time from T1 to T3. And so this one we'll call T1 plus delta TB. I think that's my pictures. And now we're almost ready to calculate. If I can find the eraser, which I threw on the floor. So first we have to look at the details of our contract here. In order to have a we want to make a quantitative statement about the difference between these two intervals, delta TA and delta TB, but we have to be careful that we're not doing unreasonable calculations. We know how to do calculations in this case just using, or what I'd like to do is I'd like to use just Newtonian kinematics. And so we're going to assume, first of all, that V over C squared is much less than 1. everywhere, that we're not, that the rocket ship isn't achieving velocities near the speed of light. And so the relativistic effects, time dilation, or perhaps length contraction, can be ignored. Anytime I write down a formula, if I see something that's proportional to v squared over c squared, we're going to say it's small enough that I just toss that away. Or I'm writing down formulas where I'm already ignoring those effects in the relativistic formulas, and so if they arise in our calculations, we have to be careful to toss them away. So the other assumption that we're going to make is that GH over c squared is much less than 1. And there's two ways to interpret that. If I put m's in front of the numerator and the denominator, it would be saying that the gravitational potential energy is much less than the relativistic rest mass or rest energy. So again, I want to be in a regime where I can do Newtonian kinematics. Another way of interpreting this is I've got the speed of light here. If I think about g over h, that can be associated with, if I go through the calculation, that can be associated with a velocity that the rocket ship reaches in a distance h. And so it's saying that the acceleration is such that in the scale of the experiment here, we're not reaching, or we wouldn't be reaching relativistic velocities again. But again, what that means is that we have to be careful if we're, in fact, I want to keep terms of that order. But if I have terms of that order squared, I'm going to be throwing them away, or I'm going to be treating those terms as being very small. Okay, so then we write some formulas down. So the first simple formula was, did I label it that way? Yes. So I can write down the trajectory of observer A and observer or observer B and observer A. XB, as we said, was just given by 1/2 GT squared. So they start at rest and then start accelerating up. XA is exactly the same, except that he gets a head start. He starts at position H and then starts at rest there and accelerates upward. So the first photon, or the first pulse, travels from here down to there, and so it travels at the speed of light over a time interval. Well, I didn't call it T0, but over a time interval from t equals 0 to T1, and the distance it covers is, it started at h, and XB has caught up, or it's arrived at 1/2 G T1 squared when it's receiving that pulse at the bottom. So the second photon, or the second, pulse. What do we have here? Well, it's the same story. It's speed of light. Now it's T3 minus T2. And it's starting at h plus 1/2 g2 squared. And this guy, or the receiver here, is now at 1/2 gt3 squared at the end of the, or when that pulse arrives. So what I want to do is I want to rewrite this difference in terms of these labels, though, the delta TA and the delta TB. So this is T1 plus delta TB minus delta TA. And on the other side of the equation, I can insert the same sets of labels, or the same parameters. And then what I arrive at is minus 1/2 g T1 squared plus 2 T1 delta TB . So that's just the T3 squared, and if I put it inside these brackets, there's a minus delta TA squared. So I'm interested in seeing what the difference between these intervals is. There's an errant T1 sitting here, but I have a nice equation up there for T1, and so I'll just subtract that out. And then I get this difference. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, how come we're writing it like this for the second pulse, that it's T2 squared minus T3 squared, instead of, like, for example, T2 minus T3 all squared?
So this was the position at this time. The position where it got sent out was h plus 1/2 gt2 squared. And where did it get received? It got received at the bottom, so the position there was just 1/2. So that's where the top was. When it got emitted, that's where the bottom is, and it gets received. And then I'm just replugging in those other formulas there. So here the h's cancel, this term cancels as well. The first term that's left over on this side is minus g t1 delta tb. And then there's also, so that's this term, then there's also this difference here, minus 1/2 g delta tb squared. Now, we don't know this, but with hindsight, well, what we know is that I expect the difference between these two time intervals to be small. And I'm looking at this, I expect it to be proportional to g. And so we can come back after we produce a result and find that what I'm saying is consistent, but the claim is that this is approximately just going to be what's in the brackets here, the difference between those squares. The leading order in the expansions that I want to do is just going to give me a factor of g and delta, one of those time intervals squared. Now, the thing is that I said that I want this quantity, or I want to treat g, if I'm thinking of dimensionless quantities, I want to treat this quantity as small. But effectively, in my equation, that means that at the end of the day, I'm going to treat these g's as small. And so what that means is that this contribution is of order this quantity g squared, and I'm going to toss it out.
And so that means I can focus just on this first term where there's a single g and a single delta t. And then there's this t1. Well, t1 is, what is t1? It's basically, you know, the time that the pulse took to get across the rocket ship. So if the rocket ship wasn't moving, that would just be hc. Because it's moving at a small velocity, well, we could do this properly or in detail. And we would end up with an expansion in that parameter, h over c squared, or h over c, rather. So t1, my claim is essentially h over c times 1 minus gh over c squared plus dot dot dot. And again, I'm going to invoke the same idea. So if the rocket ship wasn't moving, the time would just be h over c. Because it is moving, there are corrections here that are proportional to that acceleration or the velocity of the rocket ship, but that involves g. And so I can think of t1 as h over c plus corrections, and it turns out those corrections are precisely proportional to this combination, gh over c squared, which I'm saying I want to be small. Again, I can think of this as being, since there's a factor of g here, this contribution I can think of as being an order g squared contribution. And I'm going to toss this and just treat t1 as being approximately h over c. So within the approximations that I'm making here, so that I can do a Newtonian calculation, is approximately minus gh over c delta td. Or if I divide it by that c, that's the c squared. So again, I get this dimensionless combination, which I said was small. If I had kept these other contributions here, I would have been keeping terms that were quadratic over here. But I said that I'm only going to work the leading order. So this is an approximation, but it gives us a quantitative result to first order in this expansion. So again, I'm dropping this stuff here. So I can just put this, well, I can rearrange this equation. I have delta TB, the time interval between receiving pulses is 1 plus gh over c squared. And that's approximately equal to delta TA, the time between emitting the pulses at the top. So these are all just clocks that are running in a particular way as the rocket ship moves around, invoking, if we, well, oh. So now invoking the equivalence principle,
So we'll add a small little diagram here. And so we can, since the intervals registered on the clock are smaller at the bottom of the rocket ship, we would say that the clock is running slow. So height. So the time interval that I register here is equal to the time interval that we register here plus this correction factor for the change in the position in the gravitational field, or that measures. And again, this is an approximation. We were working, we're doing Newtonian kinematics to produce this result, and we're working to leading order in some expansions, both in V over C and in GH over C squared. Now I'm going to reintroduce, or I'm going to rewrite that GH. In terms of our gravitational potential that we had, that we talked about at the beginning. So so we can introduce phi. If I'm thinking about a mass, if I assign it zero gravitational potential energy here at the bottom, up here at the top, it's just mgh. So u equals mgh at the top. So for a mass, yeah.
Gravitational field has to be curl free. Or because so you say clock lowering the gravitational field has to go slower, right? So you could imagine suppose you could go down in the gravitational field all the way back to where you started.
Not sure what that means.
So like a clock in the gravitational field has to be slower. Has to go slower. So right. So if you have like a circle of clocks, like suppose the gravitational field has like, I mean, first of all, I assume this works for a uniform gravitational field. And I also assume it could work, well, we can talk about it later, I guess.
Yeah, okay, so I think the bottom line is that we're about,
I'm not sure if I'm gonna get, yeah, I will. I will get there today. I'm about to say that there's a certain formula that I can apply in a non-uniform gravitational field, but implicitly I'm writing phi in terms of a scalar potential.
Well, it doesn't have to be non-uniform, just have to, so you can do this for...
Why don't we, I'm running out of time, I want to get to a certain formula. Yeah, okay.
So if I take a mass from the bottom to the top of the rocket, the change in the gravitational potential energy is mgh. So that's just to tell you that delta phi is just gh. Or I can think of that as phi at a minus phi at xd. And so it's natural then to write delta t at some position. Well,
am I making it non-uniform yet?
Well, we might as well say that right away. So in our uniform gravitational field, it's natural to write delta T at some position Z to be equal to 1 plus phi of Z over C squared times delta T, which is measured at Z, where by definition we're going to call phi equals 0. So we're going to pick some special place. We'll say the gravitational potential is 0 there. And then relative to that point, I can use this formula here. And one of one of the things to emphasize is that this is a small quantity. If I think of So if we think of that formula that I wrote down before for a spherical mass, so I have gm over r, and then I'm sticking in this factor of c squared. So this is, I could evaluate that here at the surface of the Earth, and I get a number on the order of 10 to the minus 9, or 1. It's an effect of one part in a billion. If I did the same thing, say, on the surface of the sun, I get a slightly bigger effect, but it's still one part in 10 to the 6. But this, even though it's a small effect, it's one of our, or Einstein's, first predictions about how gravity should work. And so it should be experimentally, or it can, one can go and look for it experimentally. And remarkably, one can find these effects, namely the different in the rate at which clocks work at different heights in the gravitational field. And so the first experiments were just experiments where one built a big tower and sent signals up and down the tower, rather like what I'm describing with our in our thought experiment with the rocket ship. And I'll just close then by saying that I'm just going to rewrite the formula. In fact, I'm kind of cheating here, but so I'll say the result was derived in discussing uniform field, but having introduced the gravitational potential, it's natural to think about the gravitational potential around an arbitrary mass configuration. Extend to
I shouldn't say arbitrary, a non-uniform. And I'll write it as 1 plus. So on this side, what I have in mind then is the local interval proper time measured locally at a position given by x, the x appearing here in our gravitational field or gravitational potential. If I'm talking about planets or stars or galaxies or any localized big mass, it's natural what we need on the other side is a delta t where phi is equal to 0. But in those kinds of gravitational potentials, it's natural to think of the potential as going to 0 at infinity. And so when I write this formula, it's natural to think of this as the proper time interval measured out at infinity, where the where the gravitational effects go to 0, or phi goes to 0. So we're assuming that phi goes to 0 when x runs off to infinity. The other thing to keep in mind is with that choice here, with that assumption there, then the phis that we're talking about here are natural. It's 0 at infinity, and as we move in closer to the mass, the phis that we come up with naturally have a minus sign, as you saw in the formula I wrote at the beginning, but that's why I put this absolute value. Phi here is naturally minus gm over r. And I guess at that point I've run out of time, and so we'll carry on from there next day, unless there are any questions. If not, do you want to tell them they're not getting lunch today?
Yeah. So today's a bit of a funny day because there's no food. So it's all up to you to go and find food somewhere. Yeah. We'll try. I think